The Day in News happens here.
We have a teacher shortage in Ontario.
Every day, as events unfold, we're here for you.
And they are projecting increases in spending.
This is The Daily Review on Newstalk 580 CFRA. Or stream us anytime on the iHeartRadio app.
Here is an encore segment from The Morning Rush with Bill Carroll.
Who knew it would get messy if Major League Sports got this in bed with gambling? Who knew? Well, anybody with any common sense knew. Not that there hasn't been scandals with gambling at professional athletes in the past, but now, I don't know, there's a certain hypocrisy involved, too, when leagues get upset. Maybe that's my Shane Pinto, Ottawa Senators bias. Still don't even know exactly what he did wrong. Sounds like he let somebody else enter something in his account for him, but it's a mess. Now we have a member of the Toronto Raptors, not a star on the Raptors, but still a backup center, Jonte Porter. And, of course, the big story out of Major League Baseball right now about Otani and his interpreter. And it's just all a mess. And maybe time for a more in-depth look at this. Eric Macromalla is a sports legal analyst for TSN and Forbes, host of the TSN radio show Offside. He's been on the show before. Always good to have you on, Eric. Thank you for doing this.
Hey, Bill. So it's a great question. What has Shohei Ohtani done that is wrong? Because that's the question, right? Because he's denied having placed any bets on any sports, including baseball.
Can you start by explaining how big a figure this guy is? This is not a backup center on the Raptors. This is a big deal.
Shohei Ohtani is the face of baseball. Baseball really hasn't had a face in I don't know how long, in other than Aaron Judge over the past 10 years. Not anybody. This guy is a global figure. He's bigger than the game. He transcends the game. And he's someone that Major League Baseball and the Dodgers, who he plays for now, are relying on to grow the game. So he's a massive, massive star.
So this is a nightmare scenario for them.
I mean, it's not ideal, right? So you have his interpreter, Ipe Musahara, who racked up $4.5 million in gambling debts, allegedly. And initially said Ohtani had wired money to the bookie in California to cover those debts. And then they backpedaled the story and said, no, the interpreter stole all that money from him, accessed his bank account and wired the funds. The reason that's a problem for Ohtani is that in California, betting on sports is not legal. And so it means it's criminal to place a bet, but it's also criminal just to wire funds to a bookie. So that's the issue, is that if Ohtani wired funds to this bookie, that's a criminal act. That's why he came out and said, no, I never did it voluntarily. He stole all that money from me. I had no connection to him whatsoever.
Heard that explanation. Admitted I'm not a big baseball guy, but that's fascinating. So even if he didn't gamble and it's actually his interpreter, if he wired money to a bookie, he's breaking the law. And then you look at the change in story. It's almost as if, that explanation is not going to work. It puts you in a different kind of trouble.
Exactly. Exactly. That's why his lawyers came up and I said, no. This is he didn't do so voluntarily. In fact, he didn't do so at all. It was just an instance of, quote, massive, massive theft. And so that's why the story changed. Now, here's the question, right, is how does his interpreter have access to his bank account? So when Shohei Ohtani had his press conference a couple of days ago, he addressed everything except that, right? So that's the glaring omission, is how did Musahara have access to his account? Now, on top of that, when you, in the U.S., when you wire, because there were two wires for $500,000 each, when you wire money for that amount, there are terrorism laws and bank laws where that gets flagged. And before the money can be sent, the account holder is contacted. So he would have been contacted. So that's a question that remains unanswered.
Yeah. Okay. So it defies credibility for me in a lot of ways, this explanation. But maybe if you're living in a world where you don't speak the language, you trust an interpreter more than you and I might trust even a close friend, because you have no choice.
100%. Well, and it's even more than that, right? Let's say, because they were really, really close friends. Okay, so let's say he comes to me and says, "Hey, Shohei, I'm $5 million in debt. Can you help me out?" I go, "Say, I'll cover you. I'll send the guy the money." Maybe he didn't know that it's against the law to wire funds to a bookie, even if you're not gambling. I mean, I didn't know. I'm a lawyer. I was watching Seinfeld a week ago. I had to do research and read the California Criminal Code. It's called the Penal Code. And I found it there in section 337. Like, so if I didn't know, why would he know that, right?
Right,
so
but as a lawyer, you know, that might be a mitigating factor, but you still can't break the law just because you didn't know it was law. It doesn't
exactly. But, you know, it kind of raises the point you raised at the top of this segment, right? That gambling is everywhere, right? And so gambling is legal in sports in 40 of the 50 states. Everyone has apps on their phones. There's ease of access to gambling. Gambling has now become integrated into our sports experience. You watch sports, you watch, you know, the news on sports, you watch games. They're going through the over-under, the point spread. So it's normalized behavior. So perhaps he wasn't thinking, oh, this is against the law.
Well, it definitely has been normalized. I mean, I feel stupid. I'm not interested enough to do the research. But when I see Austin Matthews to score a goal tonight, plus 110, honestly, Eric, I have no idea what that means. I don't care to know, but I have no clue. Yeah. And they talk about it endlessly now on broadcasts like I know or care. It's just too much. I just feel like, will you shut up already about this?
You know what? A lot of people are saying this, Bill. It's a lot. And my reaction is, I want to keep this away from my sons who are 7 and 10 years old. I don't want this because we're sports fans. I don't want gambling to become part of their integrated sports experience. That's the part that scares me because some people get addicted to it, right? And it inflicts irreparable harm on their lives. That's the concern I think a lot of parents have.
Yeah. What's the situation with the Raptors player, Jonte Porter? Is that an important one? Is there much to it yet?
I think it's more important. I think it's more important because that's where the risk lies when it comes to gambling in sports. He is a fringe player, plays 4 or 5 minutes a game. It's those athletes that barely play, the guys that ride the bench, they represent the greatest threat to sports from a gambling perspective because they have less to lose. They know they have a really short career, finite earning potential, so they're going to place some bets, right? And so when he hopped on the court, there were a lot of disproportionately high number of bets being placed on him. So that's why he was removed from 2 games. They said it was for injury, but apparently that's not true. And now he's under investigation. It's those guys.
Well, this was more about trying to influence the game because of gambling too, right?
Yeah, it was prop bets. Let's say you're going to say, hey, when he's on, he'll get 2 three-pointers, right? So he'll bet on the under, meaning he'll get less than that. He'll have friends do that, for example, just his theory. And he'll miss his 3-pointer. So, yeah.
Right. So it's almost impossible to affect the outcome of a game as one player, but you certainly can affect those prop bets, which, if I understand correctly, Eric, and treat me like I'm an idiot here, that's what I just said with Austin Matthews. Like the chance of him scoring a goal in this game is a very specific thing. If you're Austin Matthews and you bet $10 million against you scoring a goal, it's easy to shoot past the post, right?
100%. So it has a direct impact on the game, and the superstars won't be placing those bets because they have a lot of money, right? They're signed to 8-year deals, 10-year deals. It's the bit players. Those are the guys who say, I have insider information. I can control certain things in the game. I'm going to start placing bets through a friend, through their app on their phone.
The problem is the two shots that he missed could be the difference between making the playoffs and not, or winning a series or not. And then it affects the credibility of the final score, which affects the credibility of the game, which affects their relationship with gambling.
Why do we have a commissioner in sports? The first commissioner was appointed by Major League Baseball in 1919 following the Black Sox scandals, or the White Sox through the World Series and the Cincinnati Reds for money. And it destroyed public confidence in the game. So with a view to restoring public confidence in the game, the owners got together and they appointed a retired federal court judge named Kennesaw Mountain Landis to be an impartial juror for the game and the first commissioner. And that was designed to get fans back on board. That's why we have commissioners in sport, because of gambling. So,
now they make deals with gambling companies.
Yes. And, you know, Pete Rose is banned for life, right? But you can't reinstate him. Why? Because banning Pete Rose for life, who gambled on his own team, has nothing to do with Pete Rose. It has everything to do with safeguarding the integrity of the game. You can't unravel and undo a really effective deterrent, especially now where gambling and sports go hand in hand.
Boy, it all feels very naive now about Pete Rose, doesn't it?
He bet on himself.
We'd want every player to do that.
You know what? He bet on himself when he played, not with money, just with heart and integrity. But then he went too far. That's just the way it goes, man. Look, the rule is clear in baseball. It's everywhere. players sign that rule, sign off on that rule from a contractual standpoint every year. It appears over the locker room. You can't bet on baseball because betting almost destroyed baseball.
Thanks for making this make sense. Appreciate it.
No problem. Take care, Bill.
Eric Macromalla, sports legal analyst for TSN and Forbes, host of the TSN show Offside.
We'll return with more of the big stories trending now on The Daily Review.
On News Talk 580 CFRA. Live, local, breaking news, weather and traffic. The day in news happens here. Now back to The Daily Review on News Talk 580 CFRA. Or stream us anytime on the iHeartRadio app.
Here is an encore segment from Ottawa at Work with Patricia Bull.
We all go through it, right? We're all growing and moving together on this planet. You're wondering why I'm going off on a tangent like this. But we're going to talk about some intergenerational dynamics here coming up and what we can learn from other generations, respecting our elders and respecting the youngest among us as well. Because when we open our hearts and minds to learning some of those lessons, we're all the better for it. I'm happy you're here joining us on News Talk 580 CFRA, as I am happy my next two guests are here joining us to talk about a book that they wrote together in maybe a kind of unlikely collaboration. We're going to talk about how it all happened. Steve Georgopoulos is right here in studio. Good morning to you, Steve.
Good morning, Patricia.
Love having you here. Jared Nickel, joining us on the line from Montreal. Good morning, Jared.
Good morning, Patricia. Thank you so much for having us.
Jared, I appreciate you being here. You're off the hook in the gift-giving department, though, because you're not right here. Steve, on a day we're talking about the high price of chocolate, has walked into studio with a little bag, with a little chocolate gift for me, and I'm absolutely thrilled about this. I'm going to take it home and share before the newsroom cohorts get their hands on it. So I love having both of you here, whether by a phone or in studio. Wonderful today. I want to ask each of you, before we start talking in detail about what's in Next Station Life, Switching to the Other Side of the Tracks, which is the name of the book that you put together. And I asked Steve off air, what genre would you say that this was? And he said, that's a tough question. I want each of you to try to describe what this book is to me before we move on. Steve, I'm going to start with you.
Patricia, you gave me the biggest favor. You described the book in your opening. And because I've been told I'm long-winded, I put four letters, C-P-R-H.
C-P-R-H.
C-P-R-H. So people will not forget the CPR, right?
Because, yes.
But it's not the CPR that Dr. Kiramantan does in the hospitals. So it's communication, patience, and respect. The H comes from for history. You and I have a history probably of 10 times that we've met. And this is the first time we're speaking one-on-one for longer than 3 minutes.
Uh-huh.
So CPRH is what the book is all about. And it's about not IT, but IS, intergenerational synergies. That's so if your listeners could remember six letters, it's CPRH and IS. And now over to Jared, who will make more sense
make
out
it
of
all,
this.
Because you're talking about what the essence is of the book and some of the message and the vibe you get from the book. But Jared, tell me how the book is sort of laid out, because it's an inspirational book, but you use little stories to kind of get at some life lessons, really.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's really like a self-help slash inspirational book that does exactly what you just said. So like our objective was, we're just trying to open people's eyes a little bit to like what happens when you open up your heart, you open up your mind to different people of all walks of life, including age. And this is where this concept of intergenerational synergies comes from. But yeah, if I had to say, to answer the question specifically, I would say it's really inspirational and self-help.
And this was an intergenerational collaboration, if I'm allowed to say that, Steve, without in any way suggesting that you're old, because you can tell as soon as you walk in that your energy and your vibe is very youthful. But in fact, you knew Jared from when he was just a young guy, right?
A very young guy. And it's interesting because the five times I met Jared before we started writing the books were at a wedding and funerals.
Mm.
And the day that I told him about the projects I'm doing was at his uncle's funeral. And guess what we said? We should get together. But we made it happen. And 3 years later, and thousands of emails back and forth, and a ritual which was Sunday, 11:30 to 1 o'clock, we met every Sunday during the pandemic, during both of our lives' little ups and downs.
With everything else going on.
That's right.
And Jared, was it about, okay, let's do something together. Should we write a book together? Let's make it happen. And then figuring out exactly what that book was going to be, what path it wanted to take, or was the idea there first, or how did it all sort of organically come together?
Well, that's a really funny story because I had just finished writing a children's book. And then my uncle passed away. Steve shows up at the funeral and we start talking. And he says, I've got a project that I've been meaning to do for about a year, 2 years, something to that effect. And I was like, okay, well, you know, tell me a little bit more. And he starts talking about writing a book. But the way he describes it, it's almost like memoirs. And so we started to meet on a regular basis. And slowly but surely, we kind of evolved together and said, like, well, okay, if we do something like a memoirs kind of story, then that's really going to be personal, right? That's really going to be all about you. And so we kind of evolved this concept to say, well, what if we took situations or life lessons that we had, and instead of putting individuals under a spotlight, what if we just, you know, made this sort of fable around some of these life lessons? And that's sort of how it came to be.
Mm. Really, really cool concept. What is your favorite story in this book? Is there a favorite sort of part of it that you really hope speaks to other people, Steve?
That's a really tough question because there's 20 chapters.
Mm-hmm. It's like I'm asking you to pick your favorite kid right now.
And I've told both my daughters I love them right 50-50, right down the middle. So if I were to have to choose one, it would be the chapter on the indigenous. Mm. And as you could see, I'm wearing my indigenous tie today. And I believe truth and reconciliation has to happen intergenerationally. You mentioned the word elders, and I have a high respect for Indigenous elders, but also other elders in my life. And one last point is, it's all about co-creation. So Monsi, that you interviewed 5 years ago, is now in Western and Ivy League. And Monsi has been one of my mentors.
Mm.
So
this is a young person that we had in studio.
In studio. Mm-hmm. And you and Graham were brilliant in inviting her at the anchor desk. After you presented her the check, the scholarship check, you invited her there. So could you imagine the impression it made on a 16-year-old girl who now is flying high, right? Ivy League. She has internships. And she also did an internship at Jared's startup company.
Mm.
So while he's doing all of this, he started a startup also.
Because you're very big on mentoring as well, Steve. And, you know, Jared, it's so interesting because we see the pressures that young people are under out there in terms of, you know, trying to live up to expectations with social media, in terms of making their way and figuring out where they're headed in a really tough economic climate. And yet there are so many who show us so much positivity, give us reasons to be optimistic when we really take some time to see, you know, beneath the veneer and to talk to them and to engage. Has that been a valuable lesson for you in putting this together? Not just about what we can learn from those who have gone before us, but what we can learn from those who are coming after us.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Like Steve said, I mean, for me personally, as writing, you know, as we were going through and writing this book, I can't tell you how much I learned from Steve, which is, that's kind of the norm, right? We look up to our elders and we sort of use them as our mentors. But by the same token, this individual that Steve's talking about, Monsi, when I invited her to join my startup, it was remarkable because she was, you know, she's about, my goodness, 20 years younger than me. And it's just, it's so fascinating to me how all evolve as a society and just how much our younger folks have to offer us. It truly is remarkable.
Who do you hope this book finds? It's been out for a little bit now. I'm seeing some positive reviews online. Who are you hoping the audience will be? Who would you really like to pick up this book and read through it, Steve?
20-year-olds and 65-year-olds.
Everyone.
Absolutely. Yeah, but it's those ages, right? It's those 65-year-olds that have to realize what the Monsies and the Kiwanis and the social entrepreneur programs do. They're doing it live right now. And it almost sounds self-serving that I'm telling you all about this, but I've lived it. So I could see the sparkle in Monsie's eyes, and it happened because you and Graham took the time to invite her there. Mm. So 20 and 65.
That's a beautiful thing. And how key is sort of the mentorship angle been for this in learning what a difference you can make in someone's life when maybe you just give them a little bit of a hand up?
It's co-mentorship, though. Mm. Monsie taught me a tremendous amount, and Jared deserves the Purple Heart for being patient with me. Right?
Is that true, Jared?
Oh, he's being very humble.
Oh yeah.
What did you learn through this writing process and engaging and sticking to that commitment and making the book happen? What would you say is the biggest lesson that you take away yourself, Jared?
Honestly, I think patience is accurate, but not in the way that Steve jokes around. It wasn't so much patience with him. It was more patience with the process. Like writing a children's book is very different when you're by yourself, you're alone, you're thinking of your own ideas and whatnot. But when you're working with another individual and you're trying to compare life lessons, I can't tell you how many technological issues we had with cameras working and not working. So yeah, I think patience really, really stood out for me.
Steve Georgopoulos and Jared Nickel, authors of Next Station Life, Switching to the Other Side of the Tracks.
We'll return with more of the big stories trending now on The Daily Review.
On News Talk 580 CFRA. Live, local, breaking news, weather and traffic. The day in news happens here. Now back to The Daily Review on News Talk 580 CFRA. Or stream us anytime on the iHeartRadio app.
Here is an encore segment from the Vashi Capello Show.
It is time for our weekly segment. I was going to say new weekly segment, but it's not new anymore. I think everyone's used to it. The Explainer.
I don't understand.
The Explainer.
And once again, thank you everyone listening who sent us in their questions that they would like answered. We picked one that I hope will help inform your decisions over the next few weeks in the lead up to April the 8th, the question comes from Molly McGee. She asks, eclipses, you wear glasses while it's occurring, but how long will it be for? And then a whole host of other questions about what actually happens during the eclipse. We're very lucky to be joined by my next guest to help us understand what's at play during that eclipse. Robert Noble is an associate professor in the Department of Physics, Engineering Physics, and Astronomy at Queen's University. Hi, Professor. Great to have you with us.
Thanks very much for having me.
I really appreciate you making the time. If I could, before we get into the question around glasses, just ask an even more basic question. What exactly is an eclipse? Like, what's happening when one that occurs?
So an eclipse is really the simplest astronomical event that you can imagine. It's the moon casting its shadow on the Earth when the moon gets directly in between the sun and the Earth. And so we just happen to be in the shadow of the moon for a few minutes or a few hours, I guess, for a partial shadow on April 8th.
And how frequently or infrequently, should I say, does that occur?
So a total solar eclipse is an infrequent event at any one place on the Earth, but they happen somewhere on Earth about every 18 months. Here in Kingston, where I am, the total eclipse that will be happening here, the last one was almost 700 years ago. So if you don't travel, they're very infrequent. But since we can travel, they happen about every year or two.
So I'm sure you've seen all the kind of consternation about who will be in school and who won't.
Yeah.
What, if you could just sort of illuminate us as to what is the danger associated with the eclipse?
Right. So the danger associated with the eclipse is the danger that you would have any other day if you were to look directly at the sun. The sun is very bright. In our eyes, when the lens in our eyes focuses the light on the back, the retina at the back of the eye, that sensitive bit at the back of the eye, can be damaged with that really, really intense light. And the problem with the eclipse is that now we want to look at the sun. It's doing something weird that we're not used to. And so therefore, our curiosity coupled with the intensity of the sun makes it dangerous. So if you're out doing your job on the day of the eclipse, if you're, you know, mowing the lawn, driving a car, just walking from one place to another, there's no particular danger. The danger is when you stop and take a look at a partially eclipsed sun, you can damage your eyes. And unfortunately, that damage can be permanent.
And how long does it take to actually sustain damage? Like if you just glance at it and hold your glance for a few seconds versus a number of minutes, like is there any discernment between that, or is it basically just don't do it, period?
Yeah, so we've all glanced at the sun for a short amount of time by mistake, and you see some spots in your eyes and we don't have permanent damage. And I think that's about the same with us now during an eclipse. Certainly the studies that I've read have been people who have looked at it for extended periods of time and gotten damage. But I don't think any time looking at an unblocked sun is safe. So try to avoid it as much as possible. Fortunately, there are really good ways to prevent it and really effective and safe ways to still be able to experience the eclipse.
Great. You led me right to the question from our listener who asks, you can wear glasses while it's occurring. Mm-hmm. Is that correct? And are these readily available on Amazon or whatever? Or, you know, how specific do we have to be?
So there's two things. So the eclipse starts out with the moon partially blocking the sun. And in much of North America, that's all that's going to happen. We'll get a partial eclipse. Those of us in a narrow swath that's about a couple of hundred kilometers wide from Mexico up through Texas, up through the central United States, and then sort of along the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence, we'll get a total solar eclipse. And that's a little bit different. In a total solar eclipse, there's going to be a few minutes where it's completely safe to look at the sun. To look at a partial eclipse, you need to block out a lot of the sun. There are glasses being sold in many locations that are these certified eclipse glasses. ISO 12312-2 is the standard if you really need to hear the numbers. But these glasses block out 99.999% of the light. You can't see anything except the sun when you're wearing them. There are many places to get them. We don't recommend Amazon or a random Google search to find the glasses.
Okay.
Here in Kingston and in Hamilton, McMaster University is giving them out. Here in Kingston, Queen's University is giving them out. And many libraries across North America are giving them out. There's a really good list of certified eclipse glass providers from the American Astronomical Society. So if you Google AAS, eclipse glasses, that's the best place to find a reputable provider.
Okay, perfect. And just for everyone listening, we'll make sure to link to that on our webpage as well so that you have all the most accurate information. So my final question for you, Professor, is will you be watching it?
I will definitely be watching. We have had incredible amounts of excitement here in Kingston. We gave out 120,000 pairs of eclipse glasses, both through the school boards and the local libraries and through Queens itself. And when we first released these on Monday, the whole city went crazy. It was like the libraries looked like Costco on a Saturday. It was
my nightmare.
Crazy.
Yeah, I lied there. We actually just got a text from a listener that I thought's a good one to ask you.
Okay.
Will your smartphone be damaged if you take a picture of the eclipse?
Your smartphone can be damaged if you look at it for too long. It is much more robust than your eyes. You can take pictures, but I wouldn't zoom in a lot on a really strong sun. That could damage your phone.
Okay, perfect. Professor, this has been so helpful. Thank you so much for making the time for the conversation.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Robert Noble is an associate professor in the Department of Physics, Engineering Physics, and Astronomy at Queen's University.
We'll return with more of the big stories trending now on The Daily Review.
On News Talk 580 CFRA. Live, local, breaking news, weather, and traffic. The day in news happens here. Now back to The Daily Review on News Talk 580 CFRA or stream us anytime on the iHeartRadio app.
Here is an encore segment from Ottawa Now with Christy Cameron.
Austin Lonsdale is an Orleans resident who drives a 2021 CRV, but he recently got a letter in the mail saying that he'd been hit, or that he would be hit, with a $400 yearly surcharge on his insurance premiums if he doesn't buy a $450 tracker that he has to get installed at a Speedy Glass chosen by the insurer. The insurance said this is because of auto thefts in Ottawa. We know there have already been more than 400 cars stolen in Ottawa so far this year. And I have Austin Lonsdale on the line right now. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
No problem. Hi, Christy.
Great to have you aboard. When did you get notified about this?
I received it. It was funny because my brother-in-law and I were chatting on the weekend, and he mentioned that someone he knew had received this type of letter from their insurance company. And I said, well, I haven't received one. I said, but my insurance company knows I park in the garage. So I said, maybe that's why I'm not getting this increase. And lo and behold, as soon as I checked the mail on Monday, this last Monday, I got that letter. And it was basically addressed to me stating that, you know, as a result of an industry-wide increase in stolen vehicles, that my Honda CR-V 2021 was identified at a high risk of theft, and that I'd be getting that annual $400 surcharge beginning when my policy renews this June.
What was your reaction to that?
I was surprised, frustrated. I mean, looking at it kind of, and again, I lease my vehicle. So, I mean, I was thinking of renewing the lease within the next 6 months to a year and a half when it's over. So, I mean, I'm really kind of on the fence what to do. I mean, do I pay the surcharge and then get one installed on the next vehicle that I'm going to probably purchase the next one? So it's kind of frustrating for me because that's a double whammy for me. It's almost $1,000.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Okay, so what's your plan?
I don't know. I really don't know. In all honesty, right now, we've got the letter. I have time to think about it, but I'm honestly thinking of getting out of maybe the CRV. I mean, it's a beautiful vehicle. I love it. But, I mean, with these thefts going on the whole bit, you even wonder sometimes coming out of a mall, is your vehicle going to be there? Because, you know, it's high on the hit list.
It's weighing on you, it sounds like, Austin, the brand of the car and how commonly it's stolen.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like my wife and I, we both joke, wonder if it's still there when we come out. Like we've joked about it several times. I mean, I watch where I park it because I want to park it in a well-secured area, heavy populated, the whole bit, well lit at night. It's in the garage every time I'm home, so it's safe there. But, you know, even like this tracking system, like I look at it, and to me, it's kind of fruitless because these folks that are doing this, the ring of people, you know, involved in the thefts, they're well organized. They're very sophisticated, high tech. To me, this tracking mechanism is just something that they will just overcome very shortly and be able to just take off with the vehicle. And that tracker will become disabled.
Can you negotiate something else?
Well, I read my letter, and it looks as though, like, if I read it, they are pointing to Speedy Glass and the whole bit, that the barcode on it, to scan it, get your nearest location. But if I read it and read it again, I could probably go and get another device installed. I don't have to by the looks of it. I didn't ask yet, but the problem is I've looked into other tracking devices, even one from Honda. There's one on their website, and it's almost $1,000.
Hmm.
Would you rather install the tracker, or would you rather just in general be charged more on your insurance because you own a vehicle that is one of the most targeted vehicles out there?
I probably would. If I do purchase another CRV, which is, you know, was my intent as of last week, I would probably just get the tracker installed. I mean, if that's what it takes, take the hit. It's $450, you know, over a 50 some thousand dollar vehicle. It's not the end of the world, but it's to me, it's the point. Now there's this, you know, it's privacy. I mean, who's monitoring where this vehicle is? And on top of that, it's probably not even going to be able to be used if it is stolen. Like I said, to me, I'm almost certain that these thieves will be able to dismantle or disrupt the beam on the signal, and they won't be able to find it anyway. The tracker will be of no use.
Chatting right now with Austin Lonsdale, a local resident who lives in the East End in Orleans, who drives a 2021 CRV. He recently got a letter in the mail saying that he was going to be hit with a $400 yearly surcharge on the insurance premium if he doesn't buy a $450 tracker that he has to get installed. And I'm hearing you here, Austin, you're expressing that you don't feel very reassured that this is going to protect your vehicle. So it sounds like you're maybe on the cusp of selling it. What would you buy? What would you replace it with?
Well, it's funny you asked that, actually, Christy, because yesterday I was speaking with my insurance adjuster, and I'd asked, I said, listen, I said, I'm not sure now if I want to purchase another CRV, but I said, I don't want to get into another vehicle that is on that high stolen list. So I said, can you provide me with a list of models that are going to have the same issue? And he sent me out a list, and there are 11 different vehicles that are on the list, ranging from the Lexus to GMC Yukon, the Cadillac Escalade, Land Rovers, Dodge Rams.
Highlander.
Yep.
Lexus RX Series, Ford F-150.
Yep. They're all there. And so it's kind of frustrating. I mean, it almost seems like most of the vehicles that I was even interested in after the CRV was my top choice are on this other list. So I don't know. You know, I do have some time to think about it, but it's I'm really questioning now what to do next, because I do love the Honda. So we'll see where that goes.
So at this point, how much time do you have to decide? When do you have to make the call?
Well, my insurance is due middle of June. So I have, you know, 2.5 months, give or take, now.
Was this something that you considered when you purchased the vehicle?
No, not at all. Because the funny thing is, on my vehicle, right in the door frame, and let me just take a look at this. I have a picture of it. Mm-hmm. On the door frame of the vehicle, it has a sticker on it, Platinum Security Protection, Invisible Vehicle Security, and then it has in big bold letters, Police Traceable. So, you know, I didn't bring that up to the insurance provider, but I'll probably give them a call tomorrow and say, listen, this is what this vehicle supposedly has on it. Is this not good enough? If it's police traceable.
Well, I guess to that end, everything is traceable unless the tool is turned off by the robbers.
Well, exactly.
Right, unless it's disabled by them, which we know that it seems like these folks work very quickly. They're highly efficient in what they do, and they turn off the tracker and they get it to the port of Montreal and poof, it's gone.
Well, that's just it. And you know, even if they couldn't disable the tracker, I mean, I would think most of these vehicles are stolen overnight. So, I mean, you're in bed. Mine's in the garage. But, I mean, for those that are in the driveway or in a parking garage someplace, it's stolen at 1, 2 in the morning. You don't realize it's stolen for another maybe 5 to 6 hours. By the time that you contact local authorities, your insurance, and get this tracker going, and then find out where it is, and then get the authorities in maybe Montreal or wherever the port is where it's going, this thing's probably already on a shipping container on a ship and sailing, you know? So I don't really see how this is going to stop it or slow it down other than put a dent in my pocket.
Great to chat with you. Thanks so much for the time today, Austin.
All righty, Christy. My pleasure. Take care.
Austin Lonsdale, a local resident, talking about this. Well, we were just chatting the other day with somebody who works in the auto industry and who works in auto insurance, Danny, and he said pretty much exactly what we just heard from our previous guest, that premiums are going up or that some people are being asked to install devices on their car. And it's presented as a choice. You do this or this, but it's one or the other. It's not just, hey, you can do this. It's or you get dinged on your insurance. Now, I'll tell you, it took everything in my power not to ask our guest if he was interested in a 2014 beat up old vehicle that's an SUV that has had two dogs in it, covered in dog hair. And it's pretty much a dumpster on wheels. It's a Hyundai. I don't want to give out the model of my car or the license plate or anything here.
Okay.
But it's a 2014, and she's had many a trip to the cottage and down the 401 on her.
She sounds like an old faithful.
Yeah, she is. She is. She's very reliable, but she's looking a little long in the tooth lately.
Okay. The dog hair is probably a deterrent, right? They'd be like, next.
Yeah, I don't need a GPS tracking system. Just follow the trail of dust and dog hair. Plus, nobody would ever steal my car. That's the deterrent in itself.
Thanks for listening to The Daily Review. Remember, the day in news happens here.
Every day as events happen, we're here for you. News Talk 580 CFRA.
Live, local, breaking news, weather, and traffic.
Or stream us anytime on the iHeartRadio app.